Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 in our very special series on Gallipoli. We are breaking down the whole Gallipoli campaign from start to finish in more than 8 hours of conversation. I tell you what, if our episode goes as long as the last one, it'll be more like 28 hours because we had a lot to say last time. Joining me for this special adventure is Mr. Peter Hart. Pete, welcome back.
Well, delighted to be back, Matt. Very, very, very big episode this. Lots of excitement and drama, lots of tragedy, of course, but I'm looking forward to dealing with it.
Yeah, this is the one that I think the Australians listening potentially are at risk of overlooking a little bit too much, which is the British and the French contribution down at Cape Helles. And particularly on that first day, it's such an important aspect of the entire story. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to do the landing at Cape Helles on the 25th of April, 1915. Anzac Day isn't just about the Australians and New Zealanders. It's also about the British and the French. So we're going to tell their story. Don't forget, like always, if you are enjoying this series and if you don't want to wait for all 8 episodes, you can download them all right now by subscribing. So click on the link in the show notes and binge on every episode back to back without having to wait for them to drop each week. Pete, let's get started. I'll say at the outset that last week, if you haven't listened to last week's episode, please go back and do that, because not only does it make more sense to listen to them sequentially, but also we covered a lot of the strategy and planning in the last episode in the lead up to the Anzac landing. So go back and check that out if you haven't, because it'll make a lot of this make a lot more sense as we talk about Cape Helles. But Pete, I've heard you give this discussion many times. I've been fortunate to be on the ground with you at Gallipoli while you gave this explanation of the Cape Helles landing. So let's now share that with the listeners. Give us your overview of what was going on at Cape Helles and the plan.
Well, what it is as we know, Hamilton's divided his forces by, you know, firstly the Anzac landing to now these landings at Helles. He decides to make a series of, they're supposed to be coordinated, but the words, are they buggery, does spring to mind. They're not coordinated. They're reliant on the Navy pouring in supporting fire from all round, because it's a very small peninsula. The Navy can almost get all round you. And he identifies, or his team rather, identifies the main beaches. And should we go through them? They are V Beach.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's talk about, it's complicated, so people might want to get a map out again, or at least a notebook and make a list, because there's a lot going on, and we'll talk about that in more detail.
There's V Beach. Now, that's in front of Cedar Bar Fort and Village. So that is a main landing. We'll talk about it. We're going to go through the landings first in outline and then discuss what actually happens. There's W Beach. That's a little further around the Helles Cape, just a bit more to the north. There's X Beach, which is to the north of W Beach. There's S Beach, which is in Morto Bay. That's to the right of V Beach, and it's just below De Tott's Battery. It's in Morto Bay, as I said. And then there's Y Beach, which is a sort of afterthought and sheer madness, as we'll discuss, which is at the bottom of a very steep set of hills and gullies. There's some great pictures of my friend Gary Bain coming down there with various bits of the tree stuck into various bits of his anatomy. Great picture.
Good old Gary. Hello, Gary, if you're listening.
He won't listen to us. That was the idea, you know, that was right up the western side of the peninsula, which was between the Turks' forward positions near the other beaches and their local reserves, which are held back at the Kilidbahir plateau. So there is another landing. We've got to mention it, although we're going to glide past it. Although you've faithfully promised to deal with the French, we're going to do the British thing and give the French a terrible job and then ignore them. So what they're doing is, because for the 2 days that they're going to take Kilidbahir, which is what the plan is, they can't have the Turkish Asiatic batteries firing across the straits into their backsides. So the French have got to land at Kumkali. And that's a separate landing, and that's an incredible story all on its own. But we haven't got, I mean, Gallipoli's a big topic. We haven't got time for everything. And we've mentioned the other diversity operations that were going on. There's also, it's not a cohesive, focused plan, is it? It's like every alternative that's open to him, he's sort of taken. And it's just a mess.
It's almost like Hamilton looked at Gallipoli like a Monopoly board and then threw down every token in every corner he could find. I mean, it's hard enough to explain on a podcast a century later, let alone actually have to go through it and carry it out.
It's just madness. Because he splits his forces so much, he doesn't concentrate his forces, and that's the whole... that's what you've got to do, Matt. You've got to concentrate your forces. Because they're so spread out, they're vulnerable to defeat in detail, because, of course, the Turks have the central position. Now, who's landing? Who's landing? Well, the landings are made by the 29th Division. And they've got one battalion of the Royal Naval Division, the Plymouth Battalion. They're going to help a bit as well, a bit. I think your description of their plan is always best. What is the plan? What's their timetable for this?
Well, we are going to land on the beaches. We're going to capture Helles and we're going to capture Krithia and Archie Barber, then Kilidbahir Plateau, then Constantinople, and then the next day it will rain beer.
That's it. Rain
facetious,
beer.
Facetious, facetious well, explanation of what the British plans were. But it's worth saying, ridiculously overconfident, ridiculously overcomplicated.
Now, we'd better have a little look at the 29th Division, because they might not be familiar to Australian listeners, and that's what most of the people will be, I think. They're the last of the British regular divisions. I always say scraped up from around the empire. They're from all over the empire. They'd never trained as a division. They didn't have their own artillery. They hadn't trained as brigades. They hadn't trained as a division. They're very good soldiers, but they haven't had the requisite training to operate. They're individually skilled, not as a formation. They're commanded by a character. I don't know what you think of him. You've just written a book on Second Krithia, so you've probably got a real down on him. He's an interesting man. I mean, what do you think of their commander, Major General Elmer Hunter Western? What do you think of him?
Well, it's interesting because I was about to ask you the same question, because I think opinions are divided on him. I said in the book that he finished the war as one of the most controversial British commanders. I don't rate him particularly highly. I think he was a good soldier. That's what I think. I think he was a good soldier. But just weird stuff, as we're going to find out. Like his absolute refusal to attack at night time, his repeated plans... repeated time and time again exactly the same thing, taking an already difficult situation and making it even more complicated. His very odd relationship with Hamilton, his commanding officer. I won't say whether he, you know, I don't know whether he in other circumstances would have been an amazing commander, but I do know in this circumstance I think he was pretty poor.
Yeah, and I agree. He wasn't stupid. It's very important, people, that he wasn't stupid, but he was a bombastic, obnoxious bastard. And that's one of the reasons people don't like him to this day. I mean, he actually predicted in his reports to Hamilton, he said, it's a great phrase that sums up the eccentricity at the heart of the man. He said that they'd end up stuck halfway across the Helles Peninsula. And his words were like a cow up a tree, which I always love. But then, British Army, 1915, he just gets on with it. He swallows his objections and just gets on with it. But the idea that they couldn't have landed at night is puzzling to you and me, I think.
Just talk to me about, specifically, before we get on with what actually happened at Hell Is, talk to me about the relationship between Hamilton and Hunter Weston, because it's just plain weird, in my opinion. The reading I've done about it is that relationship was just bizarre. It just did not make military sense.
It's strange, but I think a lot of the fundamental weirdness comes from Hamilton. He has this opinion that once he's given his orders, or overarching orders, it's down to the subordinate to do it. Now, there's nothing particularly wrong with that, but he hesitates to interfere at all. He compares it to when you fired a shot from a gun, that then the bullet or the shell has its own trajectory. And I just think that they're a bad pair for this sort of Hamilton and Hunter Weston, for this sort of operation.
I think part of that, Pete, is because Hamilton is so deferential and, you know, he tiptoes around and doesn't speak plainly quite often. I think Hunter Weston is the worst person to be on the receiving end of that, because he takes advantage of it, I think. So when Hamilton is, as we will see later, when Hamilton's dithering a bit and maybe we should do this and maybe we should do that, Hunter Weston's able just to say, bugger that, I've got my own plans and I'm sticking to them. It's a very odd relationship.
And I think agree entirely. That, I agree entirely.
That, well, the disaster we're about to discover unfolded.
So why? You mentioned it. Why land in the day? I mean, there are reasons. They're not all mad. He's worried about landing at night in uncharted waters. He's worried about the currents. There's a hell of a current coming out of the Dardanelles, as you probably know if you've ever swum near it. And he fears the awful confusion that might result. Now, it might be, I've often thought that they should have landed at night at Helles and in the day at Anzac, because it would have helped in so many ways. I still think it would have been a disaster. The thing is that he doesn't seem, he sees the problems that his orders of the day, they're unbelievable. I think you probably know them. They're basically, yeah, men, you'll do well. You may be killed by shot, shell, snipers, mines, things, but I know that once you're ashore, you'll do fine. Very encouraging for the average soldier. Anyway, let's talk about the landing site. Let's talk about that. There is one interest. There are some points of interest in the plans, and that's the V Beach landing, where they actually use there's barbed wire out, there's Turkish trenches, and at the time their only means of landing are these open rowing boats towed by steam launches. And funnily enough, one chap who's basically, he's not a senior commander, but it's commander, he was in charge of a communications yacht, Commander Edward Unwin, and he comes up with a solution. And I don't know whether you want to describe the River Clyde, because it features so large in the story. I mean, it's basically a converted trawler, isn't it? Collier.
Yeah, it's. I said in my book that maybe the British were inspired by the sight of Troy just across the Dardanelles, because they came up with their own version of the Trojan horse.
The idea, she's got with her a steam hopper, and she's got lighters to fill the gap, because they guess there might be a gap. But they haven't thought it through. We'll come back to that. Now, what do you think the men thought? What do you think the men thought who are inside the River Clyde? Because there's about 3,000 troops inside there. You've got an example, I think. Give us an example of what the average bloke... Well, he's not the average bloke. He's quite an interesting chap. But what did Captain Guy Geddes of the 1st Munsters Fusiliers think? Oh, it's me. Now, this is one of the professional things that Gary has to cope with. My inability to read the word me. This is what Guy Geddes says.
Really?
Right, you can edit that.
Let me assure you, dear listener, that Pete knows an awful lot about military history. He just doesn't recognise his own name. Don't hold that against him.
Oh, we've got to leave that in now.
I am. You're going to be Captain Guy Geddes.
I insist you leave that in, so you see what you and Gary have to cope with. I felt we were for it, that the enterprise was unique and would demand all I was possible of giving, and more, that it was no picnic but a desperate venture. I just longed to get on with it and be done with it. I felt I was no hero and that I had not the pluck of a louse. My nerves were tense and strung up, and yet I never doubted that we would not win through, because I knew the splendid fellows at my back, highly trained, strictly disciplined, and they would follow me anywhere. So very, very heroic, But underneath that heroism, there's a lot of nerves. And I mean, they knew the Turks would be expecting them. They knew they were defending. Well, V and W Beach are the two main defended beaches.
Pete, I just want to ask something about that quote. Do you recall where that quote comes from, in what form that was originally delivered? Because I suspect it's a letter, not a diary entry. Because the reason I say that, I could be wrong, but the reason I say that is he starts by saying, oh, I'm feeling a bit nervous, this all might go wrong. But then all of a sudden he catches himself and then goes on, we'll win the day through. I know the guys will follow me anywhere. And, you know, it sounds like a letter that he's writing to a friend or a family member to me. I'm not sure if that's the case.
I can no longer remember. You know my memory. As well as not being able to read my own name, I also struggle with memory. I think you're probably... It certainly has that feel. And I very much... It's got that classic, 180-degree turn halfway through it, which is indicative of that. They know the Turks are going to be waiting for them. And what's more, they also think, despite all the previous reconnaissance and the rest of it, that there's a full Turkish division waiting for them. But there isn't, is there, Matt? Who's waiting for them?
Well, bugger all, really. We discussed this
technical
in the last episode.
Very
technical military term. But we discussed this in the last episode that the Turks had this tripwire system where they had forward posts and reserves held back. And so instead of an entire division, which the British expected would be guarding Cape Helles, so we're talking 20,000 odd men was the expectation. In effect, there was less than a battalion, wasn't there, in the whole sector. And I looked this up. I actually, when I was writing the book, I got out Google Maps and looked it up. 7 kilometres is the length of the coastline along those landing beaches that was assigned to the Turkish defenders. So, pretty extraordinary.
It is amazing. Just one battalion of the 3rd 26th Regiment, and then there's a platoon of the 2nd 26th Regiment, and that's it. And I want to make this clear: no machine guns, very little artillery support. What they had refused to fire in circumstances which we'll leave to the Turks to discuss rather than us. They got very few landmines that worked, mainly at but they've got something, and what the thing they've got is good leadership, experienced, well led, well trained troops. And
just one extra thing I want to add about the 26th Regiment, Pete, is that, again, something I only discovered by looking through the Turkish records. Not me, I didn't look through the Turkish records, but those historians like Harvey Broadbent and Edward Erickson and people like that who look through the Turkish records. But the 26th had only been in there for 2 days at the time of the landing. It had been the 25th Regiment that had been digging in and building all these defences for weeks and weeks in preparation for the landing. And then absolutely at the 11th hour, they were swapped and the 25th was pulled out and the 26th were brought in. So not only were these men going to be hugely outnumbered in the landing, they had absolutely no idea of the terrain they were supposed to be defending. And their machine guns, this is how we know that there were no machine guns facing the landing, because their machine guns didn't even catch up to them after this sudden last-minute change of plans. And the only explanation we seem to be able to come up with is that the divisional commander wanted a change in the leadership of the leader guarding the beaches, the leader of the regiment, the commander. But for some reason, instead of just swapping regimental commanders, he swapped the whole regiments. So just bear that in mind as well, is that the Turkish defenders had this huge job to do in terrain that they were completely unfamiliar with.
Which makes their achievements of that day even more dramatic. Now, let's go through the beaches. Now, people say, why don't you do it in by time? Well, the thing is, they're completely separate operations, aren't they? Each one is a separate battle. And whether you look at the official histories, all the books, it's because they fight on their own, which is the whole bloody point of what a shit plan it was. Let's start with Y Beach. That's going to be a thorn in the side of the Turks. It's behind the front lines, if you like, down by the V and W Beach. It's to threaten communications with their reserve formations, and it's to act as a sort of lightning rod to attract the reserves in, rather than go down and deal with the real threat. What sort of a beach would you do? Have I taken you to Y Beach? I can't remember whether I have. Or you might have been on your own. You are allowed out. Normally you have a nursemaid, but I know. But you know, you are allowed out.
I'm going to say about Y Beach that the term, the Y bit is okay. The beach bit, that's a generous title. I haven't actually stood on it, but I've seen it from the water. and I've seen it from the top of the cliff, and it's not a beach. It's one of those weird, if you imagine, you know, like you always see in the Mediterranean, a scrubby cliff that virtually plummets into the ocean, and just before it does, there's a few metres of shingly, you know, foreshore. That's what they call Y Beach. So I can understand why the Turks didn't defend it very adequately, because it's an insane place to land. But probably, I'd say, Pete, the only really inspired part of Hamilton's plan. Because it's a long way up the coast. It's a long way northward of the tip of the peninsula. So it was actually a very shrewd flanking manoeuvre.
I would go for imaginative rather than shrewd in view of what happens to it, if you see what I mean. The landing's going to be made by the First King's Own Scottish Borderers, KOSB from now on, if I remember, which I probably won't, supported by the Plymouth Battalion. Interesting choice of mixture. And you're going to give a quote from Private Daniel Joyner of the First KOSB. What does he say, Matt?
Private Daniel Joyner says, "The main object now was to gain the top of the cliffs. This was easier said than done. The scouts had got there and found it unoccupied. We started. No attempt at order was made, nor was it expected. Hand over hand, a pull up here, a jump there, and so on. Seemingly the Turks did not know that we had landed. If they had, well, that is a different story. One Boy Scout on top of the cliffs could have kept 50 men down with chucky stones, so treacherous was the foothold." It's a great point. It's a great quote. It's a great point. One Boy Scout on top of the cliffs throwing stones could have held them back. That's the rugged nature. But there were no Turks there to hold them back. There were no Turks within cooee of Y Beach.
Now, when they got to the top, that's the problem. They do nothing. They don't do anything. They send a few scouts forward to Gully Ravine, which if you can picture it, is the other side of Gully Spur. They don't go down any to see what's happening at Gully Beach. They just don't do anything. They don't even, Matt, dig in properly. And then there's a huge drama in command and control between the two battalion commanders, both of whom think they're in charge. What a cock-up. They both think they're in charge. And then there's even worse between Hamilton and Hunter Wesson. Hamilton's saying, "You've got ashore. Do you want more men to land?" There's communication difficulties, which means Hunter Wesson gets it late, and then he ignores it. And because he's busy at W&V Beach, so it's just a complete bugger. And what
it's
happens?
One of those things, Pete. It's one of those things. Before we go on with what actually happened, it seems to me almost entirely a command issue. And I have no idea how could they possibly have landed without having this spelled out, who is actually in command and what they're supposed to do. Because after they landed, the key objective for the entire British landing was the village of Krithia and the hill called Archie Barber just behind it. And the men that landed at Y Beach actually sent scouts out who, without being obstructed in any way, actually reached the village of Krithia. They actually set foot in the edge of the village, which is really quite extraordinary. But how is it possible that the commanders didn't know what to do? They didn't know whether they were supposed to be advancing on Krithia or doing a right turn and linking up with the blokes from W and X Beaches. And then it's so infuriating and frustrating. They were sending messages to Hunter Weston saying, "What should we be doing? We've landed, you know, there's no one around. What should we be doing?" And again, he ignored them. He did not reply pretty much throughout the entire day. It's so frustrating.
It is. And remember, there's 2,000 men, best part, 2,000 men landing there. That's twice as many as there are Turks in the whole of the south of the Hellas Peninsula. So it's surrealistic. They don't dig in, but then the Turkish reserves. The 1st 25th Regiment, you mentioned, they'd the ones who had been at Hellas, and now they're back at Seraphim Farm, up on Caled Bahir. They start to arrive that evening, and they counterattack, and it goes on all night. They haven't dug in properly. It's a complete cock up. They end up scratching and behind their equipment piled up, and it goes on all night. And then at 7 o'clock on the 26th of April, there's a last desperate attack. And you again are going to be Private Daniel Joyner, 1st KOSB. What does he say about it?
This is a pretty horrific quote. It's like the drama in this quote is pretty amazing. "Down they came in greater numbers than ever. Day was just breaking. No preliminaries this time. Line after line, our rifles got hot. Wounded men were loading. Officers getting us ammunition. What little could be got. It was impossible to miss. It was impossible to last. Something had to give way. It was us. We retired, dropping back about 50 yards. Our remaining officers rallied us and we charged. The Turks were dumbfounded. They turned and ran for it. We tried to hold again, but again we were forced back. Back and forward we swayed until the Turks had us on the topmost edge of the cliffs with a sheer drop of 300 feet. The beach was littered with our wounded, in many cases dying comrades. The Turks had the chance of a lifetime. Another push and we would have been over the cliffs. We had turned at bay. Every man that could hold a rifle was brought into the line. Holding like this, we waited for the last push. No sooner had the Turks shown a hesitation than our remaining officer grasped the situation and ordered the charge. This time, everything was in a mix. Bayonets, butts, fists, feet, and in fact, everything and anyhow. So mad was the rush, the Turks gave way.
Now, what followed then is... it's amazing. what can you say other than, wow. But they're both sides by this time are knackered. And there's a sort of lull settled, helped by the fact that the ships can now see what's going on, and the Turks are very wary of that. But there's then a classic, they're evacuating the wounded. The Navy say, do you want to come off? And there's a sort of yes, no, maybes, and eventually, in sort of embarrassing circumstances, they evacuate the beach that morning of the 26th of April. It's a complete cock-up. And I'm sorry, the next two are equally bad. And we're going to deal with them quickly because we can't deal with every beach because each one is a whole story. X Beach, you've been to X Beach, I know, because I've stood there with you. We walked down the artillery road. They built down to the beach. The landing there is going to be made by the 2nd Royal Fusiliers. And here the Navy really step up their game, don't they? And they bang on about it quite a lot. What do they do that's different?
Well, they bring a ship in bloody close this time and it effectively blasts the top of the cliff off with a very close range. I think it was only like 400 yards out from the beach. That's ridiculously close for a big naval ship to come in. And it absolutely smashed the Turkish defences. Not that there were many defences to smash. When you look at the records. How many Turks were guarding this beach, Pete?
12. And possibly...
Sorry, is that 1,200?
No, 12. And possibly...
Just 12. 12 individual men.
Possibly a Nordenfelt, which was put out by the thing. So that's all there is. And what do they do? What do they do? They do nothing, essentially. They establish contact with the troops landing at W Beach, which is not far away. It's a very short walk now. We've walked it. They get in touch with them. But then they're sort of paralysed by fear of mass counterattacks. There is a counterattack, and they describe it as hordes, thousands of them, sir. And actually, there's only, at most, a company, 250, and more likely, it's only a platoon or a couple of platoons. But they panic, they go back to the cliff edge, which is bad. It's not a cliff, it's earth. And another battalion lands, and they solidify the position. What had they achieved? What had they done? What would you say?
Bugger all. They've done nothing. They'd landed again. They absolutely outnumbered the Turkish defenders, but they were paralysed by fear, as you say. I don't know whether the 12 Turks that were there received bravery awards, but they absolutely should have because they were very smart. And I read Turkish accounts of this. Their platoon leader was very... He kept his nerve very well. He realised they had absolutely... I think 600 men landed on that beach, something like that. He had no chance of stopping those men, but he said, let's hold them up as much as we can. And so they fired very carefully. They aimed at each boat individually. They fired very carefully. I don't think there was any casualties. I don't think they actually hit anyone. But just a creation of opposition just planted the seed again in British minds that, well, we're going to be in trouble if we push too far forward. And also it was at X Beach that, in a rare display of initiative, the counterattack you described was actually ordered by the company commander himself. Who had been ordered to send reinforcements elsewhere. And in a very rare display of initiative, he realised what was going on and ordered his company to counterattack at X Beach, which really saved the day. It was a great move. Again, we cannot overlook the good work of the Turks.
Oh, absolutely.
The British bumbled and struggled, and the Turks were magnificent. And this is the combination that resulted in the disaster on the landing.
Now, S Beach, now that, if you remember, is at the eastern end of Morto Bay. Can I just say
that's not a good omen, Morto, is Latin, is it, for death? Okay, boys, you're going ashore at Death Bay.
And this is the idea of this, it's the ridge that goes across the Hellas Peninsula. They're going to land, seize the TOTS battery, the positions above the beach, up on the ridge, and then they were to hold them pending the arrival of the main force from V&W later the same day. They land quite imaginatively. They go around the side, climb some pretty good cliffs, and they overwhelm the defending platoon. That's about 30 men of the 2nd 26th Regiment. That's but then what do they do? We've heard this story, so it's a repeat. What do they do? Come on.
Nothing.
You know.
They sit
you,
there.
You did know.
They can't make up their mind. They can't decide, you know, what they should be doing. One of the things I discovered too, Pete, that platoon, the picket line that was actually facing the beach, was only 9 men. So we had 12 at X Beach. We've got 9 at S Beach. We've literally got squads. We've got squads now. They're not even platoons anymore. We've got squads of men holding up battalions of British people landing. It was inertia. It was fear on the part of the British that there were hordes of Turks waiting to overwhelm us. And in reality, sprinklings, handfuls of men holding up entire battalions. It's really quite extraordinary.
And what they do is, again, as at X Beach, they fall back, they snipe, and the British don't know what to do. Again, there's most of the South Wales borders are here. Should they have left their positions there and gone and taken the Turkish defenders of V Beach in the rear? Well, they could do, but then that hill that would later on that day block their passage up the Hellas Peninsula would be left to the Turks. They might occupy it, and they don't know what to do, so they do nothing.
We should say, in defence of these blokes who are effectively landing on, you know, sort of flanking manoeuvres, we should say in strong defence of them that the main landing was at V Beach. You know, V&W beaches were the main landings. And because, as we're about to find out, they went so badly wrong, that's why there was so much misinformation. If the landing at V Beach had gone even a fraction as well as it was supposed to, the South Wales borderers at S Beach would have seen British troops advancing and linked up with them and carried on together. But as it was, because the landings were going so disastrously on those beaches, there was no sign of the troops that they were supposed to be supporting. So you can't really blame them for coming ashore and then going, well, you know, what the hell do we do now? Capture Constantinople on our own. It's confusion. It's confusion. It's one disaster leading to another. And this is the problem with not having cooperating forces. This is the problem. If you land on a beach that is too far away to be supportive of any other beach and it goes wrong, the guys on the other beaches are going to struggle as well because they don't know what's going on. You haven't arrived. They can't support you. If you land together within sight of each other and, you know, mutually supportive positions, you can say, oh, you know, they're having trouble over there. Okay, move some forces left or right. It's the huge dilemma of spreading the forces so thinly.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Now, so let's move that. That's a great summation. The next thing is W Beach. This is one of the two main landings, and it's a 300-yard beach. It's a lovely beach. It's unchanged. It's fantastic to visit. It's
incredible, isn't it? What a great spot to visit. today. It's brilliant.
If you don't see W Beach and die. And unfortunately, that was the case for a lot of the Lancashire Fusiliers who landed as well. Because they were meant to land and then advance up towards Achi Baba, Krithia and Achi Baba, picking up the flanking units from XS and Y. But the Turks have a series of trenches on the cliffs. They're still there, some of them, or just on either side of the beach. They've got trenches. No machine guns, but they've got trenches. Who's landing there? This is a name you won't, that no one can forget about W Beach, because it subsequently named it. Who is it?
The Fusiliers. The Lancashire Fusiliers. Fine body of men.
The fine body of men, yeah. And they go to land, move inland, make contact with the Royal Fusiliers at X Beach, and then seize 138, which is between W Beach and V Beach. Here, the naval bombardment is useless. It doesn't concentrate enough close to the things. They don't come in close enough. It's bloody useless. And when the tows of rowing boats and the little putt-putts come close to the beach, they come under a lot of fire. And this is what leading seaman Gilligan said. He's in charge of one of the boats. He's from HMS Euralius. I told the men to lie down in the bottom of the boat, leaving myself and six oarsmen exposed to the enemy's fire. I then ordered them all to jump out and get under cover as quickly as they could. As soon as we touched the beach, we could see wire entanglements. The fire was terrible, just like a hailstorm. I jumped out of the stern, up to my arms in water, and pushed the boat in. The sergeant jumped in front of me and got mortally wounded. The cries of the wounded were terrible. By now, the Lancashires were ashore. And we've been on that beach, haven't we?
It's extraordinary. Like it's a perfect place for defence.
It is. They've got the low cliffs on either side. They've got classic back of a cove. It's perfect. It's like an amphitheatre. They stumble forward through the waves. There's wire in the water, but they manage to get into the open sand in front of the main line of wire. And here's a quote from you, probably. Unless I've written the wrong thing down.
It does say Matt. So, yes, that's
what mine says Matt as well. Major Richard Willis of the Lancashires. What does he say?
It's horrific stuff. As ordered, the men ran up to the wire and lay down, waiting for the wire cutters to get to work. And I should throw in as an aside here, those are hand wire cutters they're talking about. They're, you know, clipping with hand these immense barbed wire entanglements. Fatal to many was that order, for Maxims began to play on the serried ranks, an easy target. Under cover of the cliff, we started cleaning our rifles, which were useless from sand and water, and it would have amused you to see men cleaning their bolts with toothbrushes with Hell's Tornado all around. I shot a sniper who was picking people off from the cliff edge. It was a good shot, and I saw him after we got up, hit in the mouth.
Now, it's
Maxims, pretty heroic stuff.
It is, but that this has got all respect for the Lancashire Fusiliers, but I personally, and most historians now, do not believe there were machine guns there. They were under heavy rifle fire. If they heard machine guns, it's from something. There is a bit of evidence within that. Why on earth would you be shooting at a sniper when you're under fire from multiple Maxims? And by the way, they took those trenches. Where are the Maxims? You can't run away with a Maxim.
I think that's probably the biggest argument in the against the fact that there were machine guns right in the front line at the landing beaches was, as you say, even in the face of horrific fire, they still got ashore. Those guns would have been captured. And as you say, where are they? There are no captured machine guns.
There'd have been no survivors. If they got multiple, either say a machine gun, either a Maxim either side, they'd have shot them to bits lying on that beach. You stood on those cliffs with me. You know you can see, you couldn't live on that beach. Who is there? Well, it's the 12th Company of the 3rd 26th Regiment. And they are not only there, they're also on Hill 114 and Hill 138 on either side. So there are only about 100, possibly 150 Turkish riflemen. And that might be exaggerated because Turks always keep reserves. But they are pouring a well-drilled, rapid fire into the lads on the beach. You would not want to do it. They are. It's 100 people firing at you, lying in a line on the beach. It's murder, absolute murder. And here's a quote I'm going to give from Major Harold Shaw of the Lancs. And he says this: On the right of me, on the cliff, was a line of Turks in a trench taking pot shots at us. Ditto on the left. I looked back. There was one soldier between me and the wire, and a whole line in a row on the edge of the sands. The sea behind me, behind them, was absolutely crimson, and you could hear the groans through the rattle of musketry. A few were firing. I signalled to them to advance. I shouted to the soldier behind to signal, but he shouted back, "I am shot through the chest." Good grief. I then perceived they were all hit. I took a rifle from one of the men with me and started in at the men on the cliff on my right, but could only fire slowly as I had to get the bolt open with my foot. It was clogged with sand. He's a much... I mean, that, for me, that's a... You notice he's not talking... He's talking about musketry. And I think it's a more balanced quote than Willis. No, it's no disrespect to Willis and what he thought was happening. And, of course, we could be wrong. Historians sometimes are. Now, one man comes to the rescue. Is it a brave soldier? Is it a corporal? Is it a captain? A major? Who rescues the situation?
It's a Brigadier General Stuart Hare.
Brigadier General. But no, they'd be in a chateau on Imbros. Surely they wouldn't be. Most of them
sipping
get killed.
Their Chateau Lafitte and eating their filet mignon in sauce béarnaise.
That's right. But no, he said, what does he do? Because he's brilliant, isn't he? He's fantastic.
He saw an opportunity to outflank the Turkish trenches, which was the only opportunity to capture W Beach, was to get up those cliffs and get behind the Turks. And so this is what he had to say about what he did. "We started scrambling up the cliff, which was a steep earth slope with layers of rock here and there. It was not very steep, but was difficult for a man in full kit to climb. There were no Turks on the front edge of the cliff, so we were defilated from the front, but were getting it pretty hot from the trenches on the east side of the mouth of the glen, which formed the beach. We could see that the Lancashire Fusiliers were shoving on straight to their front up the glen, but must have been losing frightfully from fire from the trenches on both sides. We collected about a dozen Fusiliers there and an officer, about all who had reached the top, and sent them off to charge a trench which was only about 50 yards off, not facing us, but flanking the glen leading up from the beach."
What
and
a man.
One thing I want to say about that, Pete, is not only is Hare is obviously doing brilliant work getting the men up and outflanking the Turkish trenches, but clever defence too from the Turks. The trenches are not running along the cliff edge where they would be hideously exposed to naval fire and would be, you know, overrun pretty easily. They're running along beside the gully leading from the beach. So again, very clever defence from the Turks. They knew the men would be funneled into that valley, and so the trenches were on top there.
So he's done a brilliant job. Unfortunately, he then decides to lead a patrol. The second lieutenant or corporal's job probably gets shot through the leg, and he's out for the rest of the battle, rest of the campaign. And this is, I think there's, how many brigadiers are? Four, I think three are out of the action, dead or wounded by the end of the battle. So that, hence our point about chateau generals, which is so beloved of people who just don't understand what's going on. Now, the Lancashire Fusiliers land, they move forward, and they're stretched in two different directions. They have to go to the left, to Hill 114, to connect with the people at X Beach, and they also have to attack Hill 138. Now, they don't know, the maps don't quite show that there's another hill, Gerji Baba, which is where the monument is now, the Helles monument is on this hill. And this is blocked. The hills block their way forward, and there's a little group of men, Turks again, platoon strength probably, but they're behind heavy barbed wire, and they're determined. They are absolutely determined to hold. Another battalion arrives, the Essex battalion. They come ashore around 8:30, and they try and get forward. They're blocked as well. They stabilise the line, but they're not getting any further. More battalions come ashore. They still can't get the Gerji Baba positions. I'm summarising what happened. This takes all day. They can make no contact with V Beach. They've advanced a matter of couple of hundred yards. They're not getting anywhere. And then suddenly it's nightfall, and they have totally failed to connect with V Beach. And even more so, this is one of the two main landings. They're meant to be approaching Achibaba by the end of this day, not approaching Gurji Baba or the Helles Memorial, as we would say. It's going wrong, isn't it?
It's disastrous. They're getting nowhere. They're outnumbering the Turks by a huge margin, but they're not moving forward. And it's a combination of good, solid Turkish defence. They are firing very well and inflicting a lot of casualties, but just fear from the British that at any minute the boogeyman is going to jump out from behind a hill and overrun them. That they just had this feeling. Their intelligence said there was a division of men at guarding Cape Helles, so they kept expecting this division to turn up. And in spite of the evidence that there was no division, that there was only scatterings of Turkish troops, they just did not push forward. It's poor leadership. It's poor instructions. It's an overcomplicated plan.
Brave men on all sides, but it's just bad. They're bad. The British are badly led. Let's turn to the real disaster, because you know the Lancashire's got a couple of hundred yards in there, you know, to the left and right. They're massive, two or 300 yards possibly. At V Beach, they're not quite so successful, are they? Now V Beach is another great place. Been slightly spoilt by a hotel, but it is the Turks' country. If they want to build a hotel, they can build a hotel. We support that in many ways. It's about 300 yards long again. It's got a low bank behind it, and there's some barbed wire and a Turkish garrison of about 250 men from 10th Company, 3rd 26th Regiment. The Turkish trenches, they're on the skyline. Again, stretching back and round. It's a natural amphitheatre, as people often say. I've never seen a beach that doesn't look like it, if you see what I mean. And it goes from Fort Number 1 on the left all the way round to the Seddel Bar Fort at the right. Two lines of barbed wire. There's a gap close to Seddel Bar Fort. And who's sailing into this death trap? Who's going in? Matt, who would you say? Who's going in?
Which troops are going in?
Yeah, who's going in? Well,
yeah, it's the Dubliners and the Munsters, but also this is where the River Clyde does its thing. The Trojan horse we mentioned earlier, and writing about this in the book, I was fascinated to see the Turkish perspective on this. Just imagine for a second, you're a Turkish soldier, you're in your trench, you've been bombarded. You've survived the bombardment. You know the Allies are landing. You're looking through your binoculars and seeing men come out of transports and hop into rowing boats. And then out of the morning mist comes looming this huge ship, a massive ship. And what does it do? It very slowly chug, 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 chugs into the shore. And then it grounds. It crashes into the beach. You must have been pretty bewildered by what the hell was going on, and the Turks were indeed. They did not know what was happening for quite a while.
It that's absolutely true. We'll talk about the Clyde a bit. There is a conventional landing occurring at the same time by the 1st Dublin Fusiliers, and they come in ashore. They come ashore along the beach and round the corner. Let's forget about them, and they're covered by a bombardment from the ships around, and the landing's dependent on the success of this bombardment, in my view, and it isn't successful despite what the people thought. And this is Midshipman Herbert Williams. He's on HMS Agamemnon, and he says, "Well, a good name for near Troy." All the other ships joined in until the noise and flashes were terrific. Before, everything had been so still, and the contrast was extraordinary. One could not distinguish between the different guns or ships in the roar and screech of guns and bursting shells. It was like hundreds of gigantic Maxims. The whole of Seddel Bar and the surrounding country was shelled, and in the half light, the bursting shells and the glare of the burning houses spread a reddish glow over everything. It seemed impossible that anything could live in such an inferno. Wire entanglements, parts of houses, clods of earth, and everything else was blown sky high. It was an extraordinary sight. Above all this, away inland, a glorious red sun rose, and I was quite appalled to see the terrific destruction. The town wasn't there. I've seen ruined towns before, but there wasn't a wall standing. But he's talking... I like this quote because people rely too much on personal experience, because he's talking bollocks. Because what actually happens is is that, yes, there is damage, visible damage to the village and to the fort. You could see some of the holes, or you could till the Turks repaired it in the last 10 years. You could see the holes in the forts where it had been hit. You could see the village. Even today, there's ruined the towns. But the naval shells are flat trajectory. They can't hit the trenches. And it all looks very dramatic, but it's failed. It does not take out the Turks. And when the TOWs land, the Turks hold their fire. Well disciplined, aren't they? They hold their fire until they're just very close, until they can't miss. And people say there's machine guns. There's a couple of what they call Nordenfelts, which are like mechanical machine guns. They're still deadly. And there's the men. And as they come ashore, they're pulling ashore, and you've got a quote that I think sums it up. It's Lieutenant Cuthbert Maffett of the 1st Dublin Fusiliers. What does he say?
They opened a terrible fire on us with machine guns and pom-poms, the shells of which contained an incendiary mixture. They began to hit the boat I was in very frequently and killed many of my men as we were rowing ashore. We were also unlucky enough to lose several of the blue jackets who were rowing us in. That's the Navy guys. The men had to take over their oars, and as they did not know much about rowing, the result was that we often got broadside onto the shore and presented a better target to the enemy. Just before we grounded, the boat got hit once or twice with incendiary shells and commenced to go on fire. She was also half full of water from the many holes in her by this time. Several of the men who had been wounded fell to the bottom of the boat and were either drowned there or suffocated by other men falling on top of them. Many, to add to their death agonies, were burnt as well.
Now,
that's horrific.
It is horrific. Again, he refers to machine guns, but an Nordenfelt is also known as an old pattern Maxim, and there were 12 machine guns, or 11, or 10, on the River Clyde firing at the same time. So there's no distinctive sound signature at all. Whatever it is...
The other thing about the Turkish defence was that their platoon commanders were very disciplined and gave them very specific instructions. So rather than everyone just blasting away at every target, the riflemen were ordered... to target a specific boat and pick off every man they could in that boat and then sweep to the next target and then pick off that boat as well. So if you're a man in that boat and you're hearing a couple of hundred rifles firing just on your boat at the same time, it's going to sound like a machine gun.
Now, meanwhile, the River Clyde's sort of chugging in and it doesn't land on the beach. It does, and I'm not arguing with that, but it's 80 yards off the actual things. And... what was meant to happen was a steam hopper and some old Thames lighters were meant to move round and form a bridge between a platform that had been built out. There was a platform on either side. And what had gone wrong? Well, let's have a look. Who do you think that steam hopper's crucial to this plan, right? It's absolutely crucial. So what would you have? Who would you have on it? Would you have some highly trained naval experts, you know, men who'd been under fire, perhaps lots of experience in various colonial campaigns, men who knew what they had to deliver? Would you have that, or what would you have instead?
I certainly would have that if I was commanding this operation, but I believe that's not what they had on the boats.
Yeah, they had a midshipman, an able seaman, and six Greeks who weren't even in the war. When the Turks open fire, they go, sod this for a game of soldiers. Literally, I suspect, only in Greek. And they went below the decks and battened themselves down so that the steam hopper drifts off to the left. They can't. There's no one to pull the lighters into place to form a bridge between the plankings, gangways, that ran either side of the Clyde to the front. You look at a picture of the Clyde, you'll see what I mean.
Another thing here, Pete, is to talk about timing too and a lack of cohesion, because rather than everyone landing together and overwhelming and shock and awe and, the ship's over here and the boats are landing over here, they gave the Turks a perfect opportunity. The rowboats hit the beach. You know, while the Clyde crashed into the shallows, but while they were dithering trying to get sorted, the rowboats hit the beach. So that meant the Turks could concentrate just on the rowboats. By the time they'd finished slaughtering everyone in the rowboats, the landing from the River Clyde had begun. So there was absolutely no cohesion. And one of the Turkish accounts that I read said that the Turks actually left their trenches to get a better bead on the Clyde. So if you go to V Beach, you'll know there's a spit of rocks, and that's where the Clyde sort of came ashore. The Turks actually clambered out of their trenches to overlook where they knew the men were going to come pouring out at the sides of the ship.
And the other thing
the
is
results were awful.
We created a defile. All the Turks had to do was line up in the holes cut in the side leading to the gangway. So you just fire at those holes. Everybody, you just aim at it. You don't have to. You just keep maintain your aim and keep firing at that hole. Or you can aim at the front where they all, or where the two gangways join. Now, this is where I like Commander Edward Unwin. It was his plan. He'd been put in charge of the River Clyde. And he saw it wasn't working. He could see there was no way ashore for the men. So what does he do? He decides to make the difference. That's the famous phrase that the British Army likes to use, men making a difference. And this is what he says. I dashed over the side and got hold of the lighters, which had been towing astern and which had been shot ahead by their impetus when we took the beach. These I got under the bow and found Williams, that's Sir Abel Seaman Williams, with me. In fact, his name's William Williams. The Welsh have no imagination when it comes to names. I had told him the night before to keep with me, and he did so literally. We got them connected to the bows and then proceeded to connect them to the beach. But we had nothing to secure to, so we had to hold on to the ropes themselves. When we got the lighters close enough to the shore, I sang out to the troops to come out. Now, I want you to picture that this is part of the fire discipline of the Turks. The Turks don't open a fire on them particularly because they're waiting for them to come out of a better target. That whether that was right or wrong, I don't know. But can you? They wrap the ropes around them. They're acting as an anchor, holding the bridge. That's brave. They got the VC, but that doesn't awards don't mean anything compared to the actual courage that they're showing. I don't know. It's amazing. They come out of the port side. The starboard side first. The left, and they're shot to bits. Literally shot to bits. As they try and get out, they're shot to bits. A few get ashore, and they're shot to bits on shore. Then the port side, they couldn't get out straight away because the doors had jammed. Anyway, their doors open, and Captain Guy Geddes emerges. He's the one that we had earlier who was worried. And I'll read that quote for you. He said this. We got it like anything. Man after man behind me was shot down, but they never wavered. Lieutenant Watts, who was wounded in five places and lying on the gangway, cheered the men on with cries of, "Follow the captain!" Captain French of the Dublins told me afterwards that he counted the first 48 men to follow, and they all fell. I think no finer episode could be found of the men's bravery than discipline than this, of leaving the safety of the River Clyde to go to what was practically certain death. I dashed down the gangway and already found the lighters holding the dead and wounded from the leading platoons of Z Company. That's the ones who came out the right. I stepped on the second lighter and looked round to find myself alone and yelled to the men following out of the Clyde to come on. But it was difficult going across the lighter. Now, that is a classic early war quote. And one of the things you'll notice, Matt, is very much how brave the men were to follow me. And there's quite a lot of building himself up going on in that quote. I don't mind. If you or I had done anything like that, we'd be boasting like mad about it. So I'm not criticising him in that way. I just want you to realise, for a start, there were people following him. And one of them is a quote you're going to give. And it's a lovely quote. You can listen to it on the BBC on various sites. It's Private William Flynn of the 1st Munster Fusiliers. He was acting as Geddes' servant on that day. What does he say?
He said, "Well, come on over, we go. We fall into the sea. Of course, I lost him. I came up once or twice for fresh air, and I drifted to my right, and I came up by this strip of rock. It was piled high with dead. Some of the other company, instead of running across the gangway, which they saw was useless, they must have jumped into the water and managed to get to this rock, but eventually got killed, the majority of them. I managed to just crawl onto the rock. I was exhausted. I thought that my knees had bullet holes in them all over where they'd been on the bottom like. They were still pumping lead all into the bodies, any movement. We managed to scramble onto the shore. We had about 8 or 9 feet to go, and we got behind a bank about 5 foot high, and we were quite safe there."
Now, when we say visit a battlefield and be amazed, do you remember when the first time, wasn't with me, you've been lots of times to Gallipoli without me. I don't know how you managed. when you first saw that bank, because it's still there, isn't it? I remember the first time I went there, and I just and the words "quite safe" didn't seem to be the ones that sprang to my mind because it's overlooked from the right and the left.
And if you're only below it if you're crouched in the fetal position. It's not a high bank. I think he's generous when he says it's 5 feet high. yeah. as well. Look, I'll post the photo on all our socials and everything, but the famous photo that I'm sure many people have seen, taken from the River Clyde, and you can see the men huddling behind the bank. It just looks like a grey-black strip across the middle of the photo. That's the men huddling behind the bank, and the shore is littered with corpses.
And I just want to make a point, because people don't, that what you see in front of that photograph is the lighters. And on the right are the corpses, and on the left are the still living. They've thrown the corpses to the right, and they're taking shelter as best they can on the left. It's one of the very few action photos that have ever been taken, certainly in the First World War. It's amazing. Now, what happened? That is basically it for V Beach. The British heroically capture about 10 feet. And then they're behind that. That's it. They're meant to be on Achibaba. Is Achibaba 10 feet from the sea? No, it's not. It's about 7 miles or 7 kilometres. You're better at that sort of thing than me. But they haven't captured anything. And that's it for the day. They try and get ashore. We can't go through every detail. We'll be talking for hours. They get no further. But the Turks, I want to look at the Turkish perspective. Because this is a quote, and I love this quote because it's got a mingled mixture of very well justified panic and occasional flashes of kill them all. <You know? laughs> And this is Lieutenant Abdul Rahman of the 3rd 26. It's got a slightly hysterical tone. That's down to the translation, I think. "My captain, the enemy's infantry has taken cover at the back of the Sedelbar gun defences, but the rear of these gun defences cannot come under fire. With the 20 or 25 men, amazing, I have with me, it will not be possible to drive them off with a bayonet charge, because I am obliged to spread my men out. Either you must send up reinforcements and drive the enemy into the sea, or let us evacuate this place, because I am absolutely certain that they will land more men tonight. Send the doctors to carry off my wounded. Alas, alas, my captain, for God's sake, send me reinforcements, because hundreds of the soldiers are landing. Hurry up! What on earth will happen, my captain?" And I think it sort of sums it up. And if you think he's hysterical, you'd be bloody hysterical too in those circumstances. And
20 or 25 men he's got with him. I mean, how many? I think the British tried to land 700 men in the first wave. And I think probably a couple of hundred actually got ashore. You know, 200 or 300 would have made it to be sheltering under that bank. If we look at the rowing boats and the Clyde and everything, we should say that the British aren't completely sadistic. Eventually, they even stopped sending men off the Clyde.
Oh, there's
and the majority of the men spent the night in the hold of the Clyde. Imagine what that was like. Imagine being stuck overnight in the hold of the Clyde with bullets pinging off the outside. My God.
It's only when it's dark. And this is one of the points about machine guns, because when darkness cloaks the beach, you can have machine guns lined up, ready to fire on a point. Rifles aren't quite as effective as that. And as soon as it's dark, they can get ashore. And you're going to... there's a description of how it goes. And this is Lieutenant Commander Josiah Wedgwood, number 3 Squadron, Royal Naval Armoured Car Division. And they're basically running the machine guns, the 10, 11, 12 machine guns, I never remember which, on the River Clyde. What does he say about getting ashore that night? Once it was dark.
He says, "The losses were small then. For 3 hours, I stood on the end of the spit of what had been rock in 2 feet of water, helping the heavily laden men to jump ashore onto submerged dead bodies. This is what went on monotonously. Give me your rifle, your shovel, your left hand. Jump wide. It's all right, it's only kits. Keep clear of that man's legs, can't you? Trying to persuade the wounded over whom they had to walk that we should soon get them aboard. Wounded men were brought to the end of the spit and could not be got aboard because the other stream was more important and never-ending. There they slowly sank and died."
Amazing.
I know, say it at the end of every quote, just horrific. The ordeal. We've got, you know, it's easy to look at something like the V Beach landing and talk about it from a tactical and a strategic point of view. Oh, they should have landed that battalion sooner and those guys should have gone further to the flank. Then you drill down and just look at what it meant for an individual bloke holding a rifle to be going through it. And it's just the most horrific thing. This would have been potentially the most horrific thing they experienced during the entire war. It's just awful.
And one of the quotes from Midshipman Drury, who's one of the VCs, and it's he just said, "I never knew blood smelled so strong." And that's what this is. This is a slaughterhouse. By 12:30 at night. 00.30. I always have trouble with that. On the 26th of April, the troops are all ashore. They're still not got any further, really. They're just on the beach now, but they're ashore. The landings have been an absolute and utter failure. And it's only because of one man, really, that they get any further next day. And this man has got a great name, Lieutenant Colonel Dick Doughty Wiley. Dick by name. And he organised, and one of the other colonels says that the men were a bit hesitant. They were a bit, they had the experience you just described. They were a bit sticky. They didn't want to go forward. Dick Doughty Wiley is a real hero. Got his cane in his hand, not because he doesn't want to kill Turks, but because British Army officers use them to point. It extends the arm and makes it clearer what they're doing. He organises the men. They charge. They take the fort. He refuses to take cover even when a sniper's aiming at him. Then they take the village of Sedd el Bahr. Here's my favourite quote. I'm sorry, I had to put this in. I know it's extending the length of the podcast, but I've got to put the next one in. This is Lieutenant George Davidson. He's following up, picking up casualties behind the attack through the village. And this is a great quote for animal lovers. "The only living things I saw in the village were two cats and a dog. I was very sorry for a cat that had cuddled close to the face of a dead Turk in the street, one leg embracing the top of his head. I went up to stroke and sympathise with it for the loss of what I took to be its master, when I found that the upper part of the man's head had been blown away and the cat was enjoying a meal of human brains." Now, I shouldn't laugh, but to me that's just an awesome quote. Cats are... That's just awful. They charge up, and there's an old castle at the top of the hill. It's not there anymore, Matt. I've looked for it. The Turks have looked for it. There's nothing left of it. And they get up onto Hill 141 about 2:30 in the afternoon on the 26th of April. Are there many Turks left by this time? You've heard. How many do you think? I don't know. 5, 6, 10? I don't know. There's bugger all up there by this time.
They're sensibly pulling back by now. It's the other good thing about the Turks is they didn't often stay and fight to the death, which would have been pointless. If you're 20 or 30 blokes and there's an entire battalion coming at you, a noble sacrifice to stay and fight is not the right thing to do. What you need to do is, you know, discretion, the better part of valour. You need to shoot as many of them as you can in the opening minutes and then scarper back. And that's basically what the Turks are doing. They're falling back as the Brits came forward.
And they're brave men. I think of the state of the wounded, because the wounded are going to get bayoneted. Should we have bayoneted? No. But that's what happens. So it's a terrible business. Now, they're led up there. They're led right to the top by Colonel Doughty Wiley, who is a real hero. He's done brilliantly. And then he stands there being a British officer, which means he stands there fully erect, and I use that word carefully, fully erect, you know, and sort of pour en courage les autres. And he stood there, and there's one of his men, his servant, his servant, is watching him. Private William Flynn. He gives a description of what happened next. It's utterly predictable.
He says, "I was laid down with the company, and Doughty Wiley was stood up alongside of me with his orderly. They were shouting to him, 'Get down, sir, you'll get hit,' because there was sniping. He wouldn't, and an explosive bullet hit him just below the eye, blew all the side of his face out, and his orderly got killed."
Now, that quote, again, there is real history in these personal experience quotes. There's two things I take from that. One, his orderly was killed, and that's because if a British officer stands up, his servant's going to have to stand up with him. I remember interviewing somebody who was with Lord Carver in Northern Ireland, and the IRA was shooting at them, and Ramsbottom, I think it was, had to stand with him. Because Ramsbottom was a brigadier general at the time, but he had to stand there because if the officer wasn't taking cover, he wasn't. So that's one point. The other thing is, these soldiers are not the experienced soldiers that propaganda will have that they are. It wasn't an explosive bullet or a dum-dum bullet. It was a bullet. That's what happens when a bullet hits you in the head. It blows, goes in, small, blows the other side out. It's not an explosive bullet. It's internal evidence that the 29th Division weren't as experienced as we think they are.
I think, Pete, these quotes are really important as well, because it's easy, again, to talk about the Gallipoli myth and the legend and the battalions, and at the face of it, this is what happens. The quote about the cat, the quote about Doughty Wiley basically having his head blown off. I mean, this is a battlefield. This is what's going on. It's nasty stuff, and we shouldn't glorify it. And even talking about the bravery of the men, it's bravery because of this carnage that's going on all around them. I mean, how would I, you know, how would you or I recover splattered with brains? And, you know, it's an incredible show of bravery that they were able to carry on in these conditions.
And for me, the death of Doughty Wiley, he was needed. He was the senior, most competent officer around. Most of the brigadiers were dead. He was a senior staff officer. He was needed. But one stupid act of gross overconfidence in the face of a very dangerous Turkish sniper resistance.
Well, it's inexperience again, isn't it, Pete? It's inexperience of the officers as well.
Yes.
They feel that they've probably been taught this in the, you know, in the officer training, lead by example. And so at a time when he should have been lying down and taking cover and preparing for the next advance, he's trying to set a good example, and he stands up and gets killed. It's a senseless waste.
So let's brainstorm and just go together, go through. I'll take the first because then it means I have less to do. Let's look at the reasons for the... Let's not beat about the bus. The British, 12,000 infantry landing against 1,000 Turkish infantry, are comprehensively defeated. Now, why was that? Well, I'm going to pinch the easy one and the one you've made. The outnumbered Turks had fought with a supreme combination of skill and courage. That is the first and most important reason that we failed. What have you got? Give me a reason.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious one. The British plans were ludicrously over-optimistic, and they relied on the Turks not putting up opposition. And, you know, I'm going to say that the plan was so complicated, I think the British would have struggled to take their objectives if there were no Turks shooting at them. It was a difficult, almost impossible plan to pull off. But the reason they got held up on the beaches, obviously, is they faced a hail of Turkish bullets. And that's what stopped them from advancing. That's why they couldn't reach their objectives.
I mean, it wasn't just a tripwire the Turks managed to pull off. It was they actually stopped them at the main beach. That's great.
You'd think the Turks were, you know, they exceeded all their own expectations. This wasn't the plan. The plan wasn't let's hold up the British on the beach and slaughter them as they come out of the boats. The plan was just hold them up long enough so that reinforcements can come and do the proper fighting. And so it's extraordinary. As we said at Anzac, the work of the Turks in the front line facing those landings, just extraordinary. What's another reason, Pete?
I'm going for the problems of command and control. Inadequate communication. We live in a world of mobile phones. I'm talking to you on WhatsApp after, you know. None of this exists. Sometimes it took an hour for the signal to get up from the wireless room up to the to the command centres on the ships to Hunter Weston and things. So command and control at every level in the British side was buggered. The Turks, who had the same communications, seem to have managed a lot better. That's interesting. What have you got?
Well, the separate battles. The beaches were too far apart to be mutually supportive. No one knew what was going on. You know, one point leads to the next. The problems of command and communication were amplified by the fact that no one could see what the bloody hell was going on anywhere else. So the blokes coming ashore at X Beach had no idea what was happening at W Beach. You had no idea what was happening at V Beach. Ridiculous to have an advantage of numerical superiority and then to throw it to the wind by scattering those forces hell and gone all over the peninsula.
And the last one's a small one that I often like to make. The River Clyde scheme was imaginative. It was in fact, it's a modern, they have them now, assault ships, they do have them. But they hadn't thought it through. They hadn't thought that they were creating a defile where people could be, the Turks could just aim at the holds, they could just aim at the front. They hadn't thought how to bridge it properly. They hadn't got the right people on the hopper. They hadn't thought it through. And after all, this is a point that it's made in jest, but the idea of the Trojan horse was that the Trojans would pull it in, not knowing the Greeks were in, and then take it into the centre of the city and have a big party. Do you think as the Turks saw the River Clyde coming in and lined their rifles up on the holds in the side, do you think they thought, oh, look, a big prezi, let's take it to Constantinople, have a big party? Or do you think they thought, kill them all? And And it's obvious. They hadn't thought through the details. Yeah, to you, you're the one, you're not British. I don't want to give the idea that the British weren't brave, but there's perhaps a summation you might want to make about the whole landings.
Well, it was the first landing, amphibious landing of this type to be made in the face of modern weapons in the First World War. That was symptomatic of the whole First World War. The Brits couldn't have done worse. On the day of the landing, it could not have gone worse. It was a harebrained scheme that was unlikely to succeed, and that's being optimistic. It could not have gone worse. The landing was a disaster.
Now, they couldn't have done any worse, really, and the Turks couldn't have done much better. And I think it's an amazing story. The courage on both sides is inspirational, but I'm afraid the British lost. That's the end to it, really.
Well, we've seen a repeat. We mentioned this in the last podcast about the Anzac landing. We've now got effectively the same thing happening at Helles. We've got the Allies securing the merest of beachheads held up by strong Turkish opposition, and they're not going to be out. The Turks are not going to be outnumbered for long. Their reinforcements are heading for Gallipoli. Everyone knows now where the Allies are landing and what they're trying to do, and the Turks are now rushing reinforcements onto the peninsula, and that's where we'll leave it for today. But that's the next chilling chapter of the Gallipoli story that we'll talk about next time. Pete, it's been great. Thanks as always, mate. Fantastic.
Cheers, mate. Good fun.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.